I want to recognize committee members who are present, Senator Coghill, Senator Willikowski. I expect Senator Machicki and Senator Stoltz to be joining us soon. Senator Costello has been called away. I also want to thank Rules Chair, Senator Huggins, and Senate President, Senator Meyer, for joining us today. Thank you very much. In addition, the Senate Finance Co-Chair, Senator McKinnon, is here. She is our host for today here in her committee room. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. I want to also thank Ann and Cody, who are helping us. Ann being our recording secretary, Cody doing the audio for us. So today is a great pleasure of mine to welcome Mr. John Sturgeon to the table to present his case to us. Mr. Sturgeon is a constituent, which makes me doubly proud. His case was heard before the U.S. Supreme Court recently. And you know, it's not just his case. It's Alaska's case, because the issue he's brought before the Supreme Court, having gone through the complete court system in this country, affects our entire state. And so it's important to all of us. In addition, joining him is his attorney, Matthew Findley. So welcome, Mr. Findley. It's a great pleasure to have you here as well. Mr. Findley is an Alaska attorney, works out of Anchorage. So thanks so much for being here with us. And online is Assistant Attorney General Ruth Botstein. So thank you very much for joining us, Attorney General Botstein. Or Assistant Attorney General. Also wanted to mention that Representative Keller is here in the audience. Representative Keller? Oh, there you are. I beg your pardon. Sorry, I didn't notice you. In any case, we're also going to be hearing from the Safari Club. Mr. Eddie Grasser will be speaking as well. So at this time, I would like to welcome Mr. Sturgeon, Mr. Findley. Please begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator, and fellow committee members. Thank you for the opportunity of being here. It's been a long, long run. First of all, I'd like to thank some people in this room. I actually personally donated to the effort. I'd like to thank the senators here that actually personally donated. It's appreciated very much. We've got a slide presentation. I'm not going to follow it real closely, but kind of give you an idea. This first picture is believe it or not, the Washington Post did a very favorable article on the lawsuit. This was the front page of the Washington Post, I think, the day before the Supreme Court hearing, and they had a very, very good article, in my opinion. See if we can do this the right direction here. There we go. I guess it all started in 2008. I've been hunting the same area just off out of Eagle on the Yukon River since 1971, and in 2008 I had my little hovercraft here. You can see it's not very big. It has a 66 horse engine in it, and I was actually repairing a broken cable, and I was stopped by three uniformed National Park enforcement folks. They asked what this thing was. It was a hovercraft, and they asked a lot of really good questions, like they were very interested in what was going on. And have I hunted moose here for a long time? I said yes, and they seemed genuinely interested in what I was doing and in the hovercraft. And then the tone changed completely. They actually pulled out a rule book, just like in the movies, and they opened it up, and there was one sentence that said, hovercrafts are not allowed in parks and preserves. And that if I started it, I would get a citation. I says, well, I didn't know that. It's not like I'm spinning Brodies on a gravel bar, or I'm dumping gasoline in a river or something. It's something I wouldn't have known I was doing wrong. And they said, I told them, I'll get it out of here right away. And they said, well, if you start up, we're going to give you a citation. And so I got my riverboat up there, and we put the hovercraft in the riverboat, and I got out of it without getting a citation. But the same area I'd hunted since 1971, and I'd used the hovercraft in the same area since 1991. So I've been using it for a very, very long time. And again, not very big, not very, a little bit noisy, but not any worse than an airboat.
I also want to welcome Senator Stoltz for joining us today. Welcome.
But a whole lawsuit, the foundation of it is Section 103C of ANILCA. And I'd like to turn it over to Matt. He's truly the expert on this. And Matt, why don't you go ahead here.
Yes, thank you very much. And also, since it's my first chance to speak, thank you all for being here. And thank you, Senator, for putting this together. I'm pleased to have another chance to talk about what I think is a very important issue to all Alaskans. You know, Section 103C of ANILCA is an example of something that should be simple and yet somehow was spun out into over 5 years of...
Mr. Findley, just a pause for one moment. Could you define what ANILCA stands for, just for the folks that are listening that may not know that abbreviation?
Yes, of course. It's the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Thank you.
Thank you. And I also want to welcome Senator Kelly for joining us today.
No, thank you very much. And so we'll talk in a second about the three sentences of the section of the statute, but it's important to take a step back and understand the concept of what this was supposed to capture. ANILCA, despite what the Park Service keeps trying to tell you, was not just a statute that created national parks. It was a statute that was designed to resolve longstanding land allocation issues in Alaska that started with the Statehood Act and continued with the Native Claims Settlement Act. And between the passage of the Native Claims Settlement Act in the early 70s and the passage of ANILCA in the late 70s, there were constant issues about land selections for the state, for Native corporations, what land should be withdrawn for preserves, what land should be more economically developed. ANILCA was supposed to resolve all of that. And so there were compromises made on both sides. Certainly, the over 100 million acres of parks were created, but there is also significant swaths of land that were set aside for more economic development. And that purpose is right there up in the beginning of the statute in the preamble. And one of the compromises that was made that's embodied here in Section 103C was a concern that was raised when they're about to add 100 million acres to the park system and lock up that land. Folks raised their hand, particularly the state did, the Native corporations did, and said, well, wait a minute, our inholdings are about to, or what's about to be inholdings, we're about to be surrounded by these federal parks. You know, from the Native corporations' perspective, I think, I forget the exact figure, but they're about over 40% of their land selections were about to be surrounded by these parks. These were lands given to them for economic development. And so the concern was, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to be part of the park, and we don't want to be regulated like we were. We want to be had the same status after ANILCA that we did before. And if you look at the legislative history, that's exactly the deal that was struck. It's clear throughout the passage of the statute, this was the intent. If your land's not owned by the federal government, you're not part of the park, and you're not regulated as though you're going to be. And so Section 103C, right up front in the statute, does exactly that. And then the first sentence, again, without getting into the legalese, says if the land's not owned by the federal government, it is not part of the park, period. That should have been enough to do it. If you're not part of the park, you shouldn't be regulated like you were. But they took the sentence and tried to make it even clearer and said, look, you're not going to regulate these lands as though they were part of the park. And then they really tried to make it clear in the third sentence and said, and if the federal government does want to regulate this land, it needs to go out and buy it. You would have hoped that this section would have ended the issue, but it didn't. Up until 1996, there actually hadn't been a conflict. The Park Service in Alaska wasn't trying to regulate these non-federal lands as though they were part of the park. That changed in 1996 when the Park Service changed its regulations and extended its regulatory reach to all navigable waters without regard to ownership of the submerged lands and without regard to ownership of the waters. Well, here's the problem. Under the equal footing doctrine at statehood, Alaska took title to all its submerged lands and navigable waters. So those rivers, that's state land. The federal government doesn't have title. Those rivers aren't part of the parks, and they shouldn't be regulated as though they were. Now, the state in 1996 did not actually raise a challenge to the regulation when it was promulgated, and so it sat there until Mr. Surgeon finally came along and raised his hand and said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. You shouldn't be doing this.
I want the record to reflect that Senator Machicki has joined us. Welcome, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Senator.
After a lot of thought and a lot of discussion with a lot of people, I decided to file a public interest lawsuit. And I call it a public interest lawsuit because I didn't get a citation. I didn't get a written warning. That's why I call it a public interest lawsuit. What I did was actually hired three separate attorneys that specialize in natural resource issues and separately, and I says, hey, I'm thinking about suing the federal government. I've been in business all my life, and I know that you don't want to take on a suit, especially against the federal government, unless you have a good case. And so I asked them each independently, do I have a good case here with the Section 103C, navigable waters, and the promises made in ANILCA? And all three independently came back. They didn't even know who each, the three were. And they said, yep, you've got a good case here, and you've got a good chance of winning. And the next step was to try to find some good attorneys. And so I searched around a while, talked to a lot of people, and Matt came right up to the top. And I've been very, very happy with what Matt has done. So that's how I got into the lawsuit. And maybe, Matt, this is a good place for you to step in and talk about kind of the basics of the lawsuit, what we're actually suing and what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. So the lawsuit brought what in legal circles is called an as-applied challenge to the regulation, saying, look, this regulation where you're trying to regulate navigable waters as though they're federal land, you can't do that. And the reason we had standing to bring the lawsuit was, again, thanks to John bringing the case. You know, what this slide talks about, I mentioned before about what the background of the statutory provision was. You know, up here you have a couple long quotes from the representative who introduced Section 103C. And you have two great quotes there. You know, he says, all this amendment does is restate and the irony of saying make clear beyond any doubt that any state, native, or private lands which may lie within the outer boundaries of the conservation system unit, like the national park, are not parts of that unit and are not subject to regulations which are applied to public lands which, in fact, are part of the unit. Again, very simple concept. That last quote at the bottom is in response to a query from Congressman Young, stood up and paraphrasing, but he had asked Representative Seiberling, well, that seems good, but are there any catchwords in here that some sharp lawyer can use against us later? The irony of that question. You know, his response was say, look, if your land's within the boundaries drawn in the map for the conservation system unit, it does not in any way change the status of that state, native, or private land, or make it subject to any of the laws or regulations that pertain to U.S. public lands. So that those inholdings are clearly not controlled by any of the public land laws of the United States. So you have the statutory language you just walked through. You have, and these aren't the only quotes. You have great quotes from Senator Stevens. You have great quotes from others on the Senate side that were actually sponsors of the legislation that were Democrats. Both sides of the aisle knew what was going on here. Yet the Park Service changed its position in 1996, and as we'll talk about a little bit later, we're sort of blown away by how the courts treated this when we got there.
Thank you. Gentlemen, pause for just 1 second. I want to recognize former State Senator Scott Ogun is joined us in the meeting. Thank you very much for being here. And gentlemen, as you switch back and forth, could you identify yourself? Because we have folks listening online. They know who's speaking then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. This is John Sturgeon. I guess just in summary, what is this case all about? Definitely a lot more than a moose on the Yukon River. Started out like that, but didn't end up like that. A lot of issues. The deeper I got into it, I found out that I'd really bitten off something pretty big. But we continued on and have done well. But what the case is, kind of layman's language, all about. This is a case about state sovereignty. It's about the promises made in statehood. Navigable waters are owned by the state of Alaska. The submerged lands are owned by the state of Alaska. And a river like the Yukon, where it's all kinds of large gravel bars and sandbars, those are owned by the state of Alaska. And if it's navigable with a big N, then it's owned by the state of Alaska. So it's about state sovereignty, promises of statehood. It's about the classic case about federal overreach. If you read the congressional intent, Matt just got done doing, you wonder, how does he even get to the Supreme Court? This is pretty clear. But the federal government just ignored ignored the law, in our opinion. This is also about the federal government keeping the promises it made in Anilka. Anilka was the grand compromise in Alaska between economic development, between conserving special areas, and it was a delicate balance. And part of it was that our parks and preserves and refuges were supposed to be managed differently than the lower 48. That was part of the deal. So that's what this case is all about. And also, it's another very, very important part is that it's about the federal government keeping the promises made to Alaska Native corporations. Like Matt said, 18.1 million acres of Native corporations, 44 million acres, are within the boundaries of these parks, preserves, and refuges. The federal government, after the Ninth Circuit, when they filed their petition for cert, the right way to say that? Mm-hmm. Okay, petition to cert to the Supreme Court, made it very clear that they weren't going to overuse this what they call the Sturgeon ruling in the Ninth Circuit. But the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, because what happened is that the Park Service, some of their attorneys, they have what they call their 9B rules, which is development of oil and gas on parks and private land within parks. It's the rules that they use for managing like oil development. Actually, there's 26 oil wells, I didn't realize this, within parks and preserves. But anyway, what they did is they took Alaska out of the status we weren't included in those rules before, and they used my case from the Ninth Circuit to include Alaska. So Alaska, before the Ninth Circuit decision, was exempt from those rules, and they used my case to put them back in. So they've done a great disservice to Alaska Native corporations. These Native corporations are supposed to use this land for economic development, for the betterment of their people. If you got to manage them like a park, reserve, or refuge, we all know that's not going to happen. So the Native corporations, our case is about making sure that the federal government keeps the promises they made to Alaska Native corporations also. And I guess the last thing, which is real simple, I guess, is that the federal government's got to know they have limits, too. That's what Section 103C does, and they ignored those time and again. What does Alaska have to lose? Management of all our navigable waters within conservation units. This is substantial. When they designated parks, preserves, and refuges under ANILCA, they didn't do it like they did down south. If you look at, like, Yosemite or Yellowstone, they're kind of like squares. They're legal descriptions. What they did for Alaska is they actually used ecosystem boundaries, and they included like ridgetops and rivers and that kind of thing. When they did that, they included a lot of state, private, and native land, and that's one of the reasons that 103C was put in there, to make sure there wouldn't be a problem. So the state would lose the management control over all our navigable waters that go through conservation units. They would lose management of the land within the parks, preserves, and refuges, obviously. They'd have to follow the Park Service's regulations. And we talked about Native corporations, the 18 million acres within their 44 million acres. And also you've got a lot of private holdings, like allotments that were sold, homesteads, mining claims. Even though they're private land, under the Ninth Circuit ruling, they would have to follow Park Service regulations. And maybe you go over the exchange that Justice Roberts had with the federal attorney. I think that's especially interesting. That kind of good to go over that one.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So this is Matt Finley speaking again. John mentioned we asked for certiorari from the Supreme Court, and the government came back and said, well, gee, you know, the Ninth Circuit suddenly issued this ruling that gives us plenary authority over these non-federal lands within Alaska parks, but hey, don't worry about it. We're not going to actually use this power. And what was it, less than a month after they filed that brief, the Park Service issues its new proposed revised 9B regulations saying, hey, for the first time, we're going to try to apply these oil and gas regulations on Alaska inholdings. Yet still, at oral argument for the Supreme Court, the lawyer for the Solicitor General's office again stood up and kept saying, well, this, you know, federal government, we have Park Service only does exercise this limited authority over these non-federal lands. There's nothing to see here, move along type of argument. And Chief Justice Roberts looked at her and said, well, aren't you just relying on the Organic Act and, you know, that first provision of the Organic Act, which is any regulation the Park Service deems necessary and proper to regulate land? How was that, you know, making the limitation? There's no limitation here. And, you know, certainly one of the things that I tried to make clear to the court is, you know, the 9B regulations are just the tip of the iceberg. Once they see they have this power, it's, you know, once the bull sees the fence is open, they're going to go. And that's what we thought, we worried was going to happen here.
So, Jeff Roberts, it seemed like he was very sympathetic to our case. Just to give a quick rundown of what we went through, we started in district court. This is John Sturgeon, I'm sorry. We started in district court. Didn't get exactly the best draw for judges. I know there shouldn't be any difference, that Lady Liberty is supposed to be balanced, but one thing I found out, not going through this process before, it really does make a big difference which judge you get. And we got a judge that was not very, we didn't think very sympathetic to our cause. So we lost to the district level. We went on to the Ninth Circuit, And I got a call from that one afternoon and said, John, you absolutely could not have picked three worse judges in the Ninth Circuit that are going to hear your case. We're going to just have to go through the motions. And that's exactly what it was. But I remember saying at the time is that sometimes when you get some judges that are kind of way out there, there's a silver lining. And the silver lining in this case was that what Matt said was that sometimes they just go way beyond what's reasonable. And that's what the Ninth Circuit judge panel did for us. They kind of went with a really, really way out there decision. And nobody knows for sure why the Supreme Court took the case, but one speculation is because of the Ninth Circuit decision was kind of so way out there. The justices said, well, this we just can't let this stand. So that's kind of the process we went through. Matt, you want to cover this?
Sure. We had, this is Matt Finley again, thank you. For folks who aren't familiar with the process, when you file a case before the United Supreme Court, folks can come in to support either side filing what's called amicus briefs. And, you know, one of the things that was important, I think, for getting our case heard at the Supreme Court level, and I think shows the importance of this case to a broad cross-section of Alaskans, is the broad coalition of amicus briefs that we got, who often you won't find them on the same side. We had a large group of Native corporations, both regional and village corporations, that came in, and that's partly because a lot of their Native Claims Settlement Act lands were at issue. The Alaska delegation, both Senators Sullivan and Murkowski and Congressman Young came in and filed a brief. You had a brief from a coalition of a lot of development organizations that are listed up there as well. And then we had some outside organizations like Safari Club, Pacific Legal, Southeastern Legal. And last and of critical importance with the support that we had from the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska at the district court and Ninth Circuit level had moved to intervene in the case and actually participate as a full party. Primarily on the basis that the Park Service had a practice of making the state get permits to do research on its own land. Yet somehow the Ninth Circuit found that that wasn't sufficient injury for the state to have standing, so they bounced the state at the Ninth Circuit level. The state came back in at both the cert petition and at the merit stage to file an amicus brief. They filed an excellent amicus brief. You're going to hear from Ruth Botstein and from Janelle Hefner, who did all the work on that. The state also asked for divided argument, which the United States Supreme Court will sometimes grant when a sovereign wants to argue alongside a private party, and Ruth Botstein is on the line, argued the case and did a fantastic job. And the state was a wonderful partner to us throughout this. Both Ruth and Janelle were with us in D.C. for 10 days before the argument, you know, working 14 hours a day getting ready for this. And so the state really did, at the argument level, give us some great support for the Attorney General's office. And so I think it's important to recognize that.
Very good. I want to welcome Senator Stedman, who's joined us. And Senator Michiki, you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Whomever, whichever of them chose to answer, if you can go back to the last slide. Great list of supporters that filed briefs in support. My question for you, were there any Alaska-based NGOs that filed in opposition to your case?
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, again, this is Matt Finley. On the other side, you had the National Park Service Conservation Association. Alongside them on the brief were trustees for Alaska, I believe, were in there as well. I forget all the names that were on the front, but it was that one coalition. And there was also an amicus brief from a coalition called the Subsistence Users Coalition Foundation. I forget what their exact name was. And they had both lawyers from Alaska and lawyers from D.C. in that brief as well.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Michiki?
That's my question. Thank you.
I'll let you proceed then.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court hearing itself was pretty incredible. It was kind of surreal. Didn't really hit me until you walk and look at that big building. I was pretty fortunate. My 7-year-old granddaughter sent me a picture of the Supreme Court building before I left so I wouldn't miss it. She was worried I'd get in the wrong building. Kind of hard to miss, but that was nice for her to do that. Like I said before, we're very fortunate to have some very good attorneys. And this is a very, very expensive, very lengthy process. One of the things that when we found out you know, kind of more than a moose hunter in the Yukon, I had to make a decision, kind of pull out the stops and realizing we're representing more than just John Sturgeon, we're representing all the people of Alaska, and there was just an incredible amount of support for this lawsuit. So we more or less just pulled out the stops and said, hey, we need to do whatever we need to do to win. So Matt had several lawyers at his firm that helped him. We also hired a Washington, D.C. attorney that specialized in Supreme Court cases. Matt, if you can talk a little bit about what he did as far as preparing for the case, the moot courts and stuff. Can we talk about that a little bit, Matt?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. This, again, this is Matt Finley. You've heard me mention as I'm talking about the support of the state that this two state lawyers are down there with me. We were in D.C. for about 10 to 12 days, I forget, before the argument, doing nothing but 14 hours a day preparing for the argument. I was there with two other lawyers from my firm, with Ruth and Janelle from the Attorney General's office, and then with Will Consovoy, who was the D.C. lawyer that we had hired. He had already argued two cases before the court this term, and this was the third case he was involved in. And, you know, we would go through questions with each other. We would do research. We would put together materials. We had several moot court sessions. We had moot court before the National Association of Attorneys General, and with a bunch of Supreme Court practitioners from D.C. We had a moot court at the Heritage Foundation they were kind enough to put together for us, and we also had a moot court at Georgetown Law School. And each one of those, Ruth and I were grilled for over an hour by, you know, some great Supreme Court practitioners that asked some really fine questions that really helped us hone our presentation. There were, you know, several, I've been asked multiple times, you know, after the argument itself, I had 20 minutes, Ruth had 10, and believe me, that time goes by just like that. That folks asked us, was there a question that was a surprise to you? I said, no, there wasn't, but that relates back to this, the sheer volume of hours that not just Ruth and I spent, but our entire support team spent with us getting us prepared. Again, that argument was just a tip of the iceberg compared to what our preparation was.
Again, because of the magnitude of this case, you know, Matt did whatever we needed to do to prepare for the case, and it was a lot of time and a lot of effort. I'll go over the financial part of it here in a short time. When the question, how did we do? I'm a layman. I really don't know. All I can say is that I'd much rather been Matt than the federal attorney. I think the federal attorney got a lot harder questions and kind of more hostile questions. So I think we did well. We're optimistic. Senator Murkowski and Senator Sullivan were both there to observe the actual hearing. They walked away optimistic. Again, you don't know what's going to happen. It's a you know. There was nine, now there's eight justices, and what I found out from the attorneys that specialize in this, you really can't tell a lot of times what they're thinking from the questions that they ask, because sometimes they're asking a question to make a point to another justice. They're asking questions for different reasons, not because they don't know the answer, they're just trying to make a point in some way. So, but I think we did well. I think right is on our side. I don't think there's any question. If you read the like I said earlier, the congressional intent, if you read just the plain language of the law, to me it's absolutely crystal clear, and you wonder how could they rule anything differently. But, you know, a lot of times these things get kind of wrapped around the axle and you don't know, the other things pop into it you never thought. So I thought we did very well. I've been asked many times, what are your favorite times during the whole Supreme Court thing, and I guess one of my favorites is that Judge Alito to the federal attorney. This is an exact quote to the federal attorney, and Judge Alito said, you filed a 58-page brief, and as I read it, you didn't get to the reason that the Ninth Circuit based its decision until page 49, and then you devoted exactly a paragraph to it. And why don't you concede that it's wrong? It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous interpretation, is it not? So we kind of know where he was. So, maybe, Matt, you can give him kind of your thoughts of how you thought it went and kind of what your highlights were.
Thank you. Yeah, again, this is Matt Finley. You know, I'll echo what John said. It's a very it's a dangerous game to play speculation with what their questions are. You know, also another person, my wife's a judge in the Alaska Court of Appeals. I mean, judges ask questions for lots of reasons. But, you know, I think overall we were prepared, and I think we gave a good presentation. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to appear in front of that court, and of course doing so on behalf of John, and what this was a very important issue. They were very prepared. They did ask very good questions, and, you know, we certainly choose to remain optimistic.
I want to interject something here. You know, after you guys finished that day, the Attorney General, Craig Richards, visited my office and dropped off the transcript. And I have to tell you, he was very excited at what he read in this transcript. His interpretation was that you had done very well, and he was feeling pretty optimistic about what the outcome would be. So he had quite a bravo for you.
Thank you, Senator.
People ask me what is the kind of highlight of the whole experience, and I guess that's a kind of a personal story, but the highlight for me is that Senator Murkowski arranged a after-hours tour of the Library of Congress. And we went after hours, Senator Murkowski was there, and there's quite a few Alaskans that actually went to observe the hearing. And I was there with my family, my daughter, son-in-law, grandkids and stuff, and they were all there at the Library of Congress, and they pulled out a map. The original map for D-Day, made out of foam rubber, that had all the hedgerows and the houses and the gun placements and all that stuff, and just in the right colors and everything else. And they had maps from Captain Cook's original maps. It was pretty incredible. And the other thing, it's a big thing, is that we had the actual director of the Library of Congress giving us the tour. And we were there about 5 minutes, and the director's talking away, and his phone rings. And he takes it out, and it kind of rings longer than normal. He puts it back again. He apologizes. And then about 2 minutes later, the phone rings again. And he takes it out, and he says, "I got to admit, I just got this phone yesterday, and I don't know how to turn it off." So my 7-year-old granddaughter walks out in the crowd, takes it out of his hand, shuts it off, walks back in the crowd. That was the highlight of my trip. Anyway, one of the questions I've asked all the time, too, is that what does this thing cost? First of all, way more than I thought it was going to cost. What we've, prior to actually being accepted by the Supreme Court, it was about $325,000. That's going through the district level and the Ninth Circuit, and preparing for the appeal to the Supreme Court. That part was $325,000. Now, I was very fortunate. I have a good friend, hunting partner, fishing partner, my name is Ed Rasmussen. Ed called me the first day it was in the paper and said, "John, I want to help you with this." And he's been my partner from the very beginning. He's still my partner on this whole lawsuit. So I'd be amiss if I didn't thank Ed, not from the foundation, from Ed personally. He's been my partner from the very, very beginning. But the original, the first up until we were accepted by the Supreme Court, was about $325,000. The Supreme Court portion was about $327,000, and that's just for the Supreme Court portion. If you're going to do this thing right, you've got to hire some firms in D.C. that understand what's going on with the Supreme Court. And as Matt said, you've got to prepare for it. Matt and Eva, his assistant, spent hours and hours and hours and hours preparing for it. And as Matt said, that any question the justices threw at him, they did a great job of answering. I mean, everybody I've talked to, the experts, other attorneys that were there, we were prepared. Matt was prepared, and his fellow attorney prepared. So that takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. These things are not very inexpensive. So the total cost, assuming we're done, was roughly $652,000. Now, if we get this remanded back to the Ninth Circuit, hope it doesn't, then we've got some more we're going to have to incur. But probably the biggest thing that in this whole lawsuit that's been so special is the support that we've gotten from Alaskans. It has been absolutely incredible. The number I have here is about that the donations I've received since the Supreme Court, about $235,000. That's roughly about $250,000 now. And I've never asked anybody for a penny. These are all people that have volunteered. There's a GoFundMe site. The Alaska Outdoor Council has been incredible. The Safari Club has donated. The Airboaters, the Alaska Trappers Association, individuals giving $5, $10. But when all said and done, we raised about $250,000, and they're not done yet. Up in Fairbanks, they're going to have what they call the world's largest garage sale. People are donating. Craig Campos is heading it up. People have donated boats, snow machines, chainsaws, guns, and they're going to go out in the parking lot in the springtime of the Sportsman's Warehouse, and they're going to have a big auction, all this stuff, and it all goes towards the lawsuit. So the support from Alaskans, you saw the list of people that have filed amicuses. That was pretty impressive. You don't hear your congressional delegation filing amicus in a lawsuit very often. Where you see Native corporations, the Alaska Outdoor Council, the Alaska Forest Association, Alaska Miners, a group like that, everybody got together, and it's just been incredible. To me, that's been kind of the highlight of the whole, even more than going to the Supreme Court, it's kind of touched my soul, is the support I've gotten from Alaskans. And what I have here, what I thought was pretty incredible, this is Matt's last 4 minutes of before he had to summarize his closing statement. And I think, Matt, would you like to read that and kind of answer a summary statement?
Sure, I can read it again. Maybe even improve on it this time. When I got up, and this is in context, this is about 2 minutes of rebuttal. And what I did not know at the time is that this would be the very last argument that would ever be delivered before Justice Scalia, before he passed. So what I pointed out here, the government's position here, they keep saying their authority is limited, and Mr. Chief Justice, which is what you call him in the arguments, you don't call him Bob, not if you want to go back. Mr. Chief Justice hit the nail on the head. They're relying on the Organic Act, which allows them to enact any regulations they feel necessary at any time. They've already done that with the 9B oil and gas regulations, seeking to apply those to non-federal land within Alaska. And the hits are going to keep on coming unless this court stops this interpretation and goes back to what Section 103C was meant to do, which is to prevent the Park Service from taking these lands that aren't owned by the government and regulating them as though they were part of the park. And then I went on to talk about there's another issue that came up in the argument about navigable waters and about state and federal authority over navigable waters. And there's a doctrine called the clear statement rule, which upends typically if a statute is ambiguous. Often the courts will defer to the agency interpretation of the statute. That's called Chevron deference for the lawyers in the room or for those who want to bore people at cocktail parties. But the clear statement rule turns that around and says where the federal government is trying to take over an area of traditional state authority, it's the other way. Unless the statute is absolutely clear that's what the federal government meant to do, then it doesn't happen. And so that was a debate that this was talking about. And what I mentioned, there's a lot of discussion about whether ANILCA covers official or navigable waters or not. The clear statement rule covers that question, and in that circumstance, it's a question of is anything in the statute clearly saying we are taking away state authority over navigable waters. You will not find the term navigable waters in the statute once. And then let's contrast this to other park enabling legislation. And I pulled out a provision from Olympic National Park and gave the statutory citation and said, here's what it says. The boundary of Olympic National Park, Washington is hereby revised to include within the park all submerged lands and waters of Lake Ozette, Washington and the Ozette River. And there's your clear statement. And that was it. And then the buzzer went off and we were done.
Wow.
That's a summary of my journey from broken down hovercraft on the Yukon River to standing in front of the highest court of land. Pretty exciting.
Mr. Surgeon, I understand that, and Mr. Findley, I understand that at least one of the Supreme Court justices kept referring to it as a hovercraft.
Hoovercraft.
Yes.
That was, thank you, Senator Matt Finley. Yes, that was Justice Sotomayor who kept saying, so the hovercraft your client was on. And it was important to keep a poker face and not correct her.
That was prudent. Yes. Further questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Stoltz.
Oh, just historical comments. Back years ago when the state was fighting the federal government, and we didn't have as a friendly of an administration, so the legislature took a lot of lead on that. I really want to commend Ted Popley and Ron Somerville, who are working for the legislature. They had the uncanny vision to hire on many of the state issues, including the Venati case, future Interior Secretary Norton and future Justice and then later Chief Justice Roberts to engage in the service of Alaska. So. Historically, certainly Justice Roberts has had an involvement on Alaska issues, and winning that case, arguing against Heather Kendall Miller, who now many of those organizations are on our side right now on this issue. And
I just add one thing. Sometimes out of bad experiences, and you see the issues, your case and Mr. Wild's case prompted me when we had a Safe Boating Act up for permanent renewal. I put some very strong language about not allowing the engagement of federal cooperative agreements for law enforcement, and even prohibiting engaging federal law enforcement officers on our navigable waters. So you provided us, it was too late for your case, and it probably wouldn't have been relevant to the federal government, but Mr. Wild and you both at least gave us some guidance of how we can at least not be in bed with those guys on our own volition. We get dragged in other cases. So I guess in an indirect way, your bad experiences gave me some guidance on how to fix a bill I didn't like very much. I put a pretty cool provision in it, and it allowed me, we got it passed. And anytime we can prohibit, at least keep us from getting in bed with the federal government working against the people of Alaska on navigable waters and other areas. Again, it's probably no solace to you that we closed the door afterwards, but I wouldn't have had the thought to do it if it hadn't been for you and Mr. Wild and some other egregious activities of Alaskans who have been harmed by overreach. So thank you for that indulgence, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. That was great. Any other questions for the presenters? All right. Well, I understand, of course, Ms. Hafner is here with the state attorneys with the Department of Law, and Ruth Botstein is online. And so I would welcome Ms. Hafner to the table if you would like to share some comments about the case with us. And before you start, I wanted to also recognize former Representative Bill Thomas has joined us. Welcome, Representative.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Assistant Attorney General Janelle Hafner. I'm one of the attorneys that represented the state of Alaska as amicus curiae in Mr. Sturgeon's case before the Supreme Court. On the phone is my colleague, Ruth Botstein, who's also an Assistant Attorney General. I just want to make sure if that's all right. Ruth, I don't know if you can hear me.
I can. Thank you.
Ruth and I both work in the Opinions and Appeals and Ethics section of the Department of Law. We specialize in civil appellate practice, and we were co-counsel on this case. Ruth argued and appeared on the state's behalf at oral argument before the Supreme Court last month. We're very, very appreciative of the chance to be here and appreciate the invitation today, so thank you. Madam Chair, and we were very proud to support Mr. Sturgeon in this very important case. I will give you just a few moments of a brief overview of the state's interest, which were slightly distinct in some regards from Mr. Sturgeon's in this case, and talk about our background and involvement, and then what I can do is turn it over to Ruth, who can talk to you a little bit about oral argument from the state's perspective and some of the larger implications, and answer any questions in that regard that you may have.
Would be great.
The state has long been concerned with the extent to which the Park Service and other federal land management agencies have attempted to regulate lands that the federal government does not own. From our perspective, this case has always been about who has regulatory control and authority over state lands and waters, and is that the state of Alaska or is that the federal government? From a litigation perspective, our involvement began in 2011 after Mr. Sturgeon had filed his lawsuit. And at that point, one of our senior assistant attorney generals who specializes in natural resource and some other issues brought suit on behalf of the state of Alaska against the Park Service in a very similar case with a different fact pattern that Mr. Finley touched on earlier. The hovercraft ban that was the subject of Mr. Sturgeon's lawsuit was one of a type of a small class of regulations that the Park Service had been attempting to roll out and expand over state lands and waters. another regulation, in effect, required the state of Alaska to apply, the Department of Fish and Game, to apply for a permit to access a state-owned exposed gravel bar on the Alaknik River in Katmai National Park for the purpose of conducting what we characterize as a benign scientific study. It was a genetic sampling on salmon stock, and we were required to go to the Park Service and obtain a permit to do that, even though we weren't accessing federal lands at any point. It's a fairly well-established and undisputed principle of the law that the state owns the submerged lands and the beds below navigable rivers. And part and parcel of that ownership right, that sovereign ownership right, is the right to regulate the waters that flow above the submerged lands. It's the right to regulate and manage the waters for navigation, for fishing. And that matters and is a very essential component of state sovereignty. And that right has passed to the state as a matter of constitutional grace under what's known as the Equal Footing Doctrine, and was also guaranteed in the Submerged Lands Act, which was an act Congress passed, I believe, in 1953. In any event, we filed suit against the Park Service, and the case proceeded in kind of a companion track and was handled by the same court as Mr. Sturgeon's, and the cases were essentially treated as effectively consolidated. The theme of our case was really very similar in some regards to Mr. Sturgeon's, in that we said, you know, ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, really was intended in many ways to strike a balance. It is in one part a conservation act, and no one is denying it. But it also made very clear that it would protect the state's ability to provide for the self-sufficiency of the Alaskan people. And one of the ways it did that is through Section 103C, which is the provision that we've been talking, you've been hearing a lot about today. We really focused on that provision as being an essential safeguard in allowing the state to continue to have authority to manage and regulate our resources. Ultimately, as the committee's aware, we were unsuccessful at the district court level and at the Ninth Circuit as well. At the Ninth Circuit, the court took a little bit of a divergent approach with respect to the parties before it, and it dismissed the state of Alaska's case against the Park Service on what's known as standing grounds. Standing is really a legal doctrine that says that someone needs to have a plaintiff must have a real injury, a concrete injury, and must be able to show that the court, if it rules in that person's favor, will give you some relief, that it won't just be an abstract or an advisory ruling. And it's really, the idea behind the doctrine is really to prevent a party just from airing a general grievance and saying, I disagree with something the government has done generally. In the Ninth Circuit's view, because the scientific research study that the state had used the permit for was already completed, we wouldn't be entitled to any relief or redress if we won, because the cost of complying with the permit and some of the harms that we had really focused on were already over and done with. It felt very differently about Mr. Sturgeon's claim, because he had anticipated going and using his hovercraft to access hunting grounds each year, and so it reached the merits of his legal question on what does Section 103 of ANILCA really mean. At that point, we had a few options, but we had two adverse rulings. One on the core legal question of what Section 103C of ANILCA means, and does it protect the state's management authority? And then we had this adverse decision on standing with respect to the state. What we did at that point is really take a hard look at what our goal was, and the most important thing from the state's perspective was to get the legal decision that the Ninth Circuit made on the question of 103, the core question in the case, was to get that reversed. And so we evaluated what was the best and most effective way of getting that question before the Supreme Court, and decided to devote our resources to drafting a strong amicus brief and participating and continuing to participate and support Mr. Surgeon's petition for cert. That decision was informed by a number of reasons, and including that in Supreme Court practice, which I believe Mr. Finley and Mr. Surgeon both mentioned, it's a very specialized and nuanced area of law. The court likes legal cases to come to it in a very straightforward, clean, legal fashion, with preferably not a lot of messy facts, not a lot of threshold, what are often considered threshold questions. If the court sees an off-ramp and doesn't have to get to the meat of an issue, it will take it. And both the state and Mr. Surgeon, I think, were in agreement that what we wanted was for the court to really reach this issue. So we hoped that by participating as an amicus, we would be able to highlight the state's sovereign interest in the case and continued belief that this was important and that the Ninth Circuit really got it wrong, and that that would maximize the chances of the court ultimately reversing. So we were very heartened, and we were very pleased when the court accepted Mr. Surgeon's petition, of course, and then incredibly pleased to have the opportunity. The court went further and granted the state's request to appear at oral argument, which is not unprecedented, but it is a very exceptional opportunity to have, because the state was not a party. What we ultimately received was an opportunity to present and really vindicate the state's sovereign interest in this case and illustrate for the court why we believe that this decision has meaning, not just to folks like Mr. Surgeon, but really impugns the state's sovereignty and our sovereign right to manage our resources, and to put that into some real perspective. I should add that that opportunity was made possible in large part by our great working relationship with Mr. Surgeon and his counsel, who were very gracious in ceding time that they had at the podium to the state of Alaska. And so I think our strong working relationship was very effective, both in refining the arguments and augmenting and supplementing the approach that each of us took with respect to putting these issues before the court. We had two rounds of briefing, but one is what's called at the cert stage, and that's the stage where you ask the Supreme Court to take the case. And then once the Supreme Court decides to take it, and at the cert stage, you really try and paint a good narrative, and you convince the court why your case matters, what the broader implications and interests are. And then once the Supreme Court decides to take the case, you have another opportunity to submit another round of briefing, and we filed a second brief where we really attempted to convince the court that the Ninth Circuit got it wrong, really highlight the state's interest, and our primary goal throughout our argument in both briefs and the argument, which Ruth can talk about in a moment, is why the state's sovereign interest in its natural resource management matters so much. Congress does not lightly take away a state's authority to manage its lands and waters, and that's a legal doctrine, and we really built on that. And the court knows that, and that's something that's invoked fairly frequently, as are these notions of federalism and the state's rights and state sovereignty. What we tried to do was really drive home the practical, kind of bring that down from an academic level and say those issues matter in Alaska in a very unique way that they don't matter in the rest of the world. And to say, look, there are real world harms here that extend to Mr. Surgeon and well beyond to the state as a whole. We explained in part that the Statehood Act and ANILCA and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act were this trilogy of legislation that all in their own way really tried to account for the Alaska's specific needs and challenges. We highlighted kind of the size of the state, the remote nature, the fact that, you know, so many Alaskans live unconnected from the road system, what not living on the road system looks like here, really highlighting the transportation and infrastructure barriers that exist throughout much of the state. And part of that was to say to someone who's living in Washington, D.C., who might not be so familiar with what Alaska looks like, when you impose an access restriction on a river or you authorize the Park Service to roll out these regulations on a nationwide basis and lump in Alaska lands and waters, you're doing a lot more than simply telling someone they can't kayak on the Potomac River or curtailing someone's ability to use a snow machine on a well-used trail in Glacier National Park. You know, what those sorts of access restrictions mean here are rural Alaskans can't get fuel delivered in the winter. that you will impede winter ice road traffic, that you will impede commercial fuel shipments to, you know, hub communities, medical supplies, the ability to get to and from one's home. And that was really, I think, the theme of our case, was to say, number one, we have a sovereign right to manage our resources, and that has historical importance here to provide for our people. And that number two, given these unique challenges and the realities of what rural Alaska and Alaska as a whole looks like, there's a more of a value of local decision-making and the need for the state legislature and decision-makers who have expertise in and familiarity with Alaska, the reality of daily life in Alaska, to be making these sorts of land management decisions. And so that's what we really attempted to do, was to frame this sovereign right to manage our lands and resources in a very contemporary, real-world way, and show how the ramifications of this decision and taking away that local control would matter and harm everyday Alaskans. I don't know if Ruth wants to jump in now. It might be a good point.
Sure. Ruth Botstein with the Department of Law. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. If you would introduce yourself for the record and give us any of your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Ruth Botstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law. And like Ms. Hafner, who spoke before me, I'm in the Opinions, Appeals, and Ethics section. Can the committee hear me all right?
Yes, we can hear you very well.
Thank you. So I want to echo the comments from Ms. Hafner and Mr. Finley and Mr. Sturgeon to thank the committee for holding this hearing today and inviting me to present. It really was an honor and a privilege to represent Alaska in this case. It's not very often that Alaska gets the chance to appear in person before the United States Supreme Court and to talk about issues of such centrality to our state and our people and preserving our way of life and our sovereignty on a national stage in this way. And it was really a tremendous experience. And I definitely agree with the comments that this is Alaska's case, and that everyone in the state has something to gain or lose here. So it was really tremendously gratifying to be part of this. I also think we were able to handle this case internally within the Department of Law, which also I think was a really wonderful thing for the state. As Senator Stoltz mentioned, in the past we've sometimes hired outside counsel, like now Chief Justice John Roberts, to work with the state on federal cases at this level. And I was really pleased that we had the support of the Department of Law and Attorney General Richards in being able to handle this internally. I hope that we were able to capably represent the state and its interests on the national stage.
Very good. Thank you. Did you have further comments?
Oh, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the argument itself. I think it's right that you can't predict what's going to happen based on the argument, but I do think it went well. I think the court was very interested. I think we had a chance to clarify some confusion that I hope will be helpful as the court makes its decision. And I was pleased that I got a chance to talk a little bit about what life is like for rural Alaskans and how these sort of access restrictions that the federal government wants to place on state use and access of its lands and waters really affects everyday people. And I do think that's always valuable because so many people who live in major urban East Coast areas really don't have any idea what it's like to live in Alaska and depend on a river to travel to hunt for moose to feed your family, and those concepts may be foreign with the kind of East Coast lifestyle. So I was certainly pleased that the court was receptive to those ideas and attentive when I was speaking about that.
Very good. Thank you very much, Ms. Botstein and Ms. Hafner, for working on this case and for aptly representing the state of Alaska. Committee members, any questions for either of the Assistant Attorney Generals? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
We're now going to hear from Eddie Grasser. He is with with Safari Club International. He also played a role in this case. Certainly the organization helped support Mr. Sturgeon. So welcome, Mr. Gresser, if you'd put yourself on the record and give us your remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Gresser. I live in Palmer, Alaska, and I'm Vice President of Safari Club International and Chair of their Governmental Affairs Committee based in Washington, D.C. I wrote out our comments for the committee, and I think that the previous speakers ably covered the case. It is an important case for us, and we certainly want to thank Mr. Sturgeon for taking this case forward, and I'm appreciative of all the Alaskans that are involved in supporting him. We're trying to do that also and have donated to the case. But what I'd like to speak to now is where do we go from here, win or lose? Safari Club International is the world's largest hunting organization, hunting-based conservation organization, and as our logo says, we're first for hunters. We've been entering into engagements with the federal government for the last 5 years, actually a little longer than that, starting with the polar bear issue, and our feeling that the reasons for listing that were erroneous. Probably none of you have heard of the Three Amigos case, but there was a case in Texas where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told our members that they couldn't hunt antelope. Now, these were exotic species imported from Africa, and they were on private land, but because they were endangered in Africa, we couldn't hunt them here. Never mind that the only chance for reintroducing these into the wild were the ranches in Texas that were hosting these animals. That's the only place they lived in the whole world. They had been extirpated in Africa. And they had a good breeding program. They had a lot of antelope. And the alternative for them, since they couldn't charge for hunting anymore to help sustain their operations, and this was perfectly okay with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, was to extirpate those herds. So the absurdity of some of these federal rules that are coming down the pike, whether they're affecting people like Mr. Sturgeon here in Alaska or our members in Texas. We just won a case in Florida on black bear hunting, and we're entering into a case in North Carolina on wolves. My point here is that the federal government is moving forward with efforts to regain or take over wildlife management across the nation. It's not just here in Alaska, which was a central concern of ours in the Sturgeon case, primarily for the access issue. If you read our brief, our attorney, Anna Seidman, reiterated several times that if you can't access lands and waters, you can't get there to hunt. And her example was a float plane. So what are we doing? SCI just had a huge meeting in Las Vegas. At that meeting, we met with the leadership of NRA, Wayne LaPierre, Chris Cox Company. We've been meeting with the Wild Sheep Foundation, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and others, and primarily the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation. Some of you sitting at this table are members of the Legislative Outdoor Caucus here in Alaska, in the Alaska Legislature. You're members of a group called the National Assembly of Sportsmen's Caucuses. So we're also working with that group. There's now 48 states that have a Sportsman's Caucus, including Alaska. And we're thinking Hawaii's going to join here pretty soon. So we're trying to build a team. We're trying to get a team together that's on the same page to start fighting back. And one of our things, and we've been very clear to our congressional delegation, that we want Congress to clear up this issue of federal versus state management of fish and wildlife. There's a savings clause in a lot of federal acts, including ANILCA, that basically says that nothing in the act either diminishes or enhances state management authority. We want that change to make it clear that the state does have management authority. That's an issue we're working on. And we're building this team, we're going forward, and we certainly would hope that Alaska would be at the forefront of that fight. The fact of the matter is we met in Vermont. There was 35 states present of the 48 member states for the National Assembly of Sportsmen's Caucus meeting this last fall. And at that meeting, we adopted a resolution or a generic resolution for each state to take home and work on, sending a message to their delegation in Congress asking them to do something about this problem of federal state management. So that's one of the key issues, one of the key platforms that we're utilizing to move forward with the issue. So in closing, I want to thank everyone in the room again, especially Mr. Sturgeon. We think it's a travesty that a private citizen had to carry this case all the way to the Supreme Court. This is definitely a public interest lawsuit that you would hope that the governing bodies that represent the people would have carried forward. I realize we're in tough economic times. But we just had a very successful event in Vegas. We raised about $22 million. So we're working on different fronts to alleviate the concerns with these issues of state-federal management. And we stand ready to join you or any other state in doing so. I've been in California. I've been all over the place this last year working on this issue. And states are, even the eastern states, are starting to realize that they're in jeopardy based on what happened in North Carolina and Texas. So the good news is we fought one battle in Texas this year, and Hunter's won 81% of the vote. So, on a ballot initiative. So, that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Grasser. Questions for Mr. Grasser? Senator Huggins.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Grasser. I forgot the date and time of the SCI seminar in Anchorage, or the fundraiser.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Huggins, it's February 27th.
February 27th. Thank you.
For those that you don't know, it's the biggest sportsman event of the year in Alaska.
Really? Wow. Great. Further questions for Mr. Grasser?
Veterans events on the 26th.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grasser, for joining us. Mr. Sturgeon, do you have any closing remarks you'd like to make?
Not really, just to thank the support that I've gotten from Alaska. It's just been incredible. It's like the old days in Alaska where everybody pitches in and helps you. The people call me and send $5, $10 is pretty incredible. The other thing, too, is I think that we've got to keep this fight up. I think the federal overreach is not going to stop, as Matt said up there, is that they're just going to keep on coming until they're stopped. And we all see, especially people in the outer doors. I've been spent my entire life in the timber industry here in Alaska, and I've certainly seen it there. And I think we just got to start pushing back, and this was one way we pushed back. So encourage the legislature, whatever you can do to push back, and the federal government when they're overreaching. I think it's something we have to do. And thank everybody for their support. And thanks for the opportunity to talk today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sturgeon. Senator Machicki had a question for you.
Actually, Mr. Sturgeon, I don't have a question. I want to thank you. I want to talk just for a second about your page on the total cost of the lawsuit, and God bless you for all of your commitment to this. But my statement is about when you think about the state sovereignty and ANILCA Section 103C challenges to the rights of Alaskans for access and land and water use, you have a zero for the state of Alaska contribution to date, and I don't think that's the case. Even with these tough economic times, we, through Ms. Happner and Ms. Botstein and the Department of Law's work, I'm proud that we did contribute. And the reason I'm making that statement is I could probably name a few states that wouldn't contribute to an effort like this that would be more in favor of the federal control of their lands. And I'm very proud of our state for standing up for itself in this effort. So I would expect that to continue.
Yeah, the state of Alaska has helped a lot as far as, you know, the amicuses and providing expertise. We wouldn't even have thought of going to the Supreme Court if we didn't have the state of Alaska standing alongside us. That was just kind of a money that was contributed. So, okay. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Sturgeon? Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I think clearly Mr. Sturgeon fits in the category some of us would characterize as great Alaskans. And but having said that, you know, once upon a time, the Red Sea was parted. The Jews walked out of Egypt. And no matter what the count is on the Supreme Court, I'll bet my Diet Coke you win. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for inviting Mr. Sturgeon in the state of Alaska. So a life-changing event, there's no doubt about it. So thank you. Those of us in the legislature try to find every way we can to help Alaskans stand up to the federal government. I think this is one giant part of it. But to be fair, I think the state has been helpful, and I think that the probably the Supreme Court appearance would not have happened. But it's also true, isn't it, that all the amicus briefs and everything cost you money. So, I mean, it wasn't exactly a total free ride that the state was willing to help with. So I just wanted to put that up, that even though we were help, we're a little bit of a costly help in some ways, even though I think the issue itself at the end of the day may roll over the top and everybody wins. But this is something that concerned me, that that the weight really didn't fall on the state in that regard. And so I think that's just something that the people of Alaska should know, that even though we came alongside, it's a partner that cost a little bit to come alongside with, but at the end of the day may be very valuable for the end result.
Yeah, the state was absolutely invaluable. They were, Matt mentioned many, many times that they were incredible people to work with. The attorneys were top quality, and the testimony they gave, or the attorney they sent to D.C., both for the moot court and everything else, were just top-notch. And so I make it real clear, State of Alaska, without the help of the State of Alaska, we wouldn't be where we're at. And they were very, very helpful. The money, what I was going over is the money part of things, what was contributed. Because that's a question I get asked a lot. But the State of Alaska did contribute a tremendous amount through their assistance in providing amicuses, and even bouncing things off of the State of Alaska, our attorneys, was invaluable. So,
yeah. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Cockfield.
Greatest appreciation for those attorneys from the State of Alaska who spent hours and hours and hours doing that. And I just wanted to let people know there's more to the story, because when you cross, when you're doing pushing paper back and forth between each other, there's a cost. And when you're doing time for review and re-review, it's just time consuming. And if a state lawyer asks a question, it costs money to get the answer.
Absolutely. All the people that filed, all the undies that filed amicuses, Matt and his team had to review those to make sure we were all in unison. Plus, I think that we didn't want to have somebody with amicus make the same point over and over again, so we kind of, they picked different points to make, so there's a lot of coordination there. But we had to review all the amicuses. Matt and his crew had to review all those amicuses to make sure we were doing the best job we could.
I just wanted that point to be made, that it wasn't that we were unwilling to offer effort, but sometimes our friendship is costly, but at the end of the day it might be worth the effort, because the Supreme Court actually got to hear it, and hopefully we can get this one over the top. This is one of many that we'll have to deal with in Alaska. I'm sure Anilka needs to be defended, and I think even some of the testimony that we had in front of Congress once again is bringing several titles of Anilka to bear. And this is, I can remember talking with my dad years and years ago about trying to stand up for Alaska. It's a perennial discussion. But I think your battle might be one of those that puts an exclamation point to some parts of it. So me, deepest gratitude.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank
you again for the opportunity to present my case here. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Sturgeon, we often hear the statement that one person can make a difference, and you certainly embody that. Win or lose, you have made a difference. I think about that couple in Idaho that the EPA went after for wetlands violation far, far from any water body. Took it to the U.S. Supreme Court also, again, as single people, citizens, standing up against government overreach, and you're another example of that. So thank you very much for your courage in following up on this. Thank you.
Again, my pleasure, but I had a lot of help from a very able attorney and lots of other Alaskans that were standing behind me and are still standing behind me. So
yes,
hard to take a credit by myself, because I had a lot of help. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So that concludes our hearing today. But before folks rush off, I know there's multiple receptions tonight. We all go our separate ways at 5 o'clock. But immediately following this meeting, we're having a reception for Mr. Sturgeon and the team down in the Butrovich Room, the room where we typically meet for our Resources Committee. So I welcome everyone to join us there. This concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be Monday, February 22nd. And so we'll adjourn at this time. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:45 p.m.